Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared.
Christopher Brown. So, as we said on our last jaunt through American horror history, 9/11 was kind of a moment in terms of changing how the landscape of this particular genre was. But first, of course, there was the terrible events on that day in 2001. And unsurprisingly, some horror films got buried. So, an example of that would be Session 9. It's an independent made psychological horror film from Brad Anderson, and it was written by him as well with Stephen Gavidon. And I don't think he could ever say it was ever going to be huge, but it certainly would have had a bit more longevity and a bit more, it would have been seen more, particularly, you know. But I think, you know, any film star and David Caruso is never going to be possibly the grand hit that his filmmakers would have hoped, if I've been a bit honest. Anyway, the story's about this asbestos team who are in there to try and clean up this abandoned mental asylum. And they start listening to these audio tapes and start to realise that there's some very nasty things going on in there. So the film wasn't a financial success. And I think this wasn't like a one-off thing. Another example of a film that struggled after a terrorist attack would be The Descent, which was right in the middle of its marketing campaign in London when the London bombing happened in 2005. And that film also just kind of slipped away because personal moods just kind of shift, and it almost doesn't seem appropriate in times of violence on our screens in such a way that, you know, your city is under attack, to then kind of pop off to the cinema and see some gore. Although the film, unsurprisingly, like a lot of movies, have kind of then gained a cult following. The big peak in the early noughties was around remakes of, remakes generally was an ongoing theme in this period of time, but remakes of Japanese films in particular. The Ring and Ring 2 from 2002, and The Grudge from 2004, and the better film Dark Water from 2005, all taken on those Japanese influences which we discussed in our last episode. Certainly, The Ring is an okay retread through similar waters, and the same with The Grudge. They realised what shocks worked in the original Japanese and kind of replicated them with an English track and, you know, more recognisable stars. Like Sarah Michelle Gellar, for example, for The Grudge. It kind of like petered away, and certainly by 2008's One Missed Call, the appetite for those films was just not there anymore. Indeed, with the exception of The Ring, most American remakes of Japanese horrors have not been received critically well, although they have received some kinds of cash. One Missed Call actually received a 0% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, so certainly a far way away from fresh. And The Ring and The Grudge have constantly been rumoured to be rebooted, but never actually happened. The other side of this is, say for example, Hideo Nakata, who was the director of the original Ring, made Ring 2, which is not a direct remake of the Japanese Ring sequel, and it does it in a way that doesn't really stand out very well. And, But having a Japanese director with that kind of history is no guarantee that the film would be any better. Nakashi Shimizu directed the original Juon, which is The Grudge, directed The Grudge Remake and The Grudge 2. Now, both those films are perfectly fine retreads of the same material, but, you know, again, there are so many Grudge movies, you know, pick one. Stick with that one. That'll do you, probably.
Thank you. was wrong. What happened there?
So while that was going on, and I think it's fair to say that the question is, how would society be impacted on the events of the world at this time? Effectively, America and Britain were aiming towards war, and then finally at war, Afghanistan, and again with Iraq. As we know, as we've spoken of before, wartime is not good time for horror, normally. But this time it kind of was, but in a different way. In 2003, there was an Australian short horror film that was 9.5 minutes long called Saw. It was directed by a guy called James Wan, directed and written by Wan and his mate, Lee Winnell, who later came on starring it. It was used as a pitch short, really, for a full-length feature film that could be built on a short, small budget, using mainly one location, also called Saw. And it finally created in 2004. The actual short itself was remade as a scene in the film, so you don't really need to hunt it out if you don't want to. It's the bear trap scene, starring Shawnee Smith as Amanda character, which if you know the films, is becomes more prominent in them as we go along, with the reverse bear trap. The character in the short is called David. Anyway, the film was released in 2004, and it's a psychological horror directed by Wan and his debut. And it was written by Lee Whannell. And it's the first installment of this 7-part Saw franchise. But originally, it was written originally, and then they just couldn't get the money together to make it in 2001. So they kind of proved that it was possible to do, and eventually was green lit. It's picked up by Lionsgate, and it was the most profitable horror film since 1996 Scream, which greenlit a Saw movie a year before it was dominated the Hollywood Halloween box office. So it's a phenomenon, but I think the question is why? Why did it resonate so much? Saw at its essence is a 7 ripoff with more visceral gore. It has that look and feel. It's washed out. It's pretty unpleasant, but it's very much a concept movie. Two men wake up in a bathroom. They're tied to a chair. There's a saw in the room and a dead body. What happens next? It's Reek's B-movie, but became this huge success. Now, I think one of the reasons is that at its core, despite its real hysteria of a film, it kind of really kind of screams at you for quite large portions of it to try and kind of communicate the terror of the situation of their characters, is that at its heart, before we get involved and bogged down in just like more and more vicious traps, I think there's a turning point in that series, probably in Saw 3, when it just all becomes about people getting ripped apart and these ridiculous contraptions. But the monster, the baddie, is doing it pretty much because of the sins of you've created, things you've done wrong. And not just that, it's kind of just because he doesn't like you. He's seen what you do. You might be a drug addict. You might have a row of failed marriages. You might be lazy in work even. You might, not contribute to society in a meaningful way. And he's like, right, well, I'm going to teach you a lesson about that. And you're either going to prove that you want this life, or you're going to die in a nasty way. And also, it kind of fights this idea. It fights this idea that people are selfish, effectively selfish beings, and they're being punished for their selfishness. And I think it feels like we could all be, you know, you could all wake up one day in this trap and, you know, you've been judged. Now, that's a kind of echo to what the attacks on the Twin Towers said. You know, that there were people out there that would go to extreme lengths to kill. They're effectively just people going to work. You know, they're not political figures. They're not soldiers. They're not, you know, they're not diplomats even, or symbols of anything apart from symbols of American life. And somebody would deliberately go after them. And I think those two things resonated. However, on the other hand, as with a lot of those things, that initial fear becomes compounded and changed and altered to the point that it ultimately becomes about scary traps and acid falling on you and all that kind of stuff.
Someone there? I can hear you. Who is that? Who's in there?
Speaking, he's not really a murderer. He never killed anyone.
Dr. Gordon, your aim in this game is to kill Adam. If you do not, then Diana will die.
He finds ways for his victims to kill themselves.
I'm sick of people who don't appreciate their blessings. I've given you a life purpose.
Looks like our friend Jigsaw likes to book himself front row seats to his own sick games.
He doesn't want us to cut through our chains. He wants us to cut through our feet.
Most people are so ungrateful to be alive. Not anymore.
You are a drug addict. Do you think that is why he picked you?
He helped me.
Don't believe Adam's lies.
Eli Roth's Hostel from 2005 kind of takes a similar point from its fear effect. And its sequel is about kind of the nature of capitalism and being able to buy your way out of trouble because you're rich and American. But the original is effectively, I'm assuming you don't know the story, it was about a group of lads who go to a Slovakian town, get fucked up, and then get really badly messed up by people in a torture chamber where rich businessmen have paid for the privilege of killing them. So it's kind of like a slow burn frat comedy for the first 45 minutes. There's about 10 minutes of violence, and then it's a chase movie at the end. And it wasn't sold like that. It was sold on its that 10 minutes in the middle of people getting caught. And it's quite extreme kind of violence, which is there, but it's not, you know, it's certainly not what you know, it's not as gory as probably, you know, if you've not seen it, you would imagine from its reputation. But there's one scene in it that's really interesting for me. They look at the price list for how much it costs. So, you know, Europeans cost more than locals. And, you know, maybe I can't remember solely, but I think it's women cost more than men. And Americans are the most highly prized because people would just love to kill Americans. And I think that's an interesting touch. The Slovakian people, or certainly the tourist board, did not like this film. Complaining that, you know, obviously it portrays a horrendous view of this country, and it does, but it doesn't look like Slovakia in truth. It looks like, you know, a generic Eastern European. I suppose, you know, it's not that surprising. And Ralph says that he didn't mean to be offensive, saying that, in quotes, "Americans do not even know what this country exists. My film was not a geographical work, but aims to show Americans' ignorance of the world around them." And then kind of more flippantly suggested that people still wanted to go to Texas after the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is fair enough as well, I feel. But I think that, again, is interesting. You know, the film focuses on an ignorance that there is a world outside there, and it's a hostile world that, you know, you're effectively cotton-wooled. And because of that, when things get serious, you've got nowhere to go. So this idea of Americans as prey. Okay, so these two films kind of launched a kind of series. Although I would argue neither of them are actually really what the films they weren't to be. I mean, the core fear of Saw and Hostel as Americans as prey. There are a few notable entries in what is Queen Kona's The Torture Porn genre, which effectively has just disappeared from view now. It's strange. Strange the way things change. There's some notable decent ones, in particular The Lovely Ones, which is an exploitation film, which I believe I might have mentioned in our Australian episode. David Elderstein wrote a piece kind of daubing this as torture porn. It's been used by his detractors really as basically being, you know, it's only obsessed with seeing people carved up, etc., etc. And it kind of, you know, revels not just in, you know, nudity and violence and sadism, but also selling itself as that. And, which effectively puts it slap bang in exactly the same as the splatter films of Herschel Gordon Lewis. They just happen to be a bit more realistic now and possibly a bit more somber, which probably in truth matches the times rather than the intention of the directors. By 2009, all that was over. And it was not a particularly noted genre. Instead, what we got was a succession of remakes of either slashers or, mainly slasher films in truth. Amityville Horror got remade, though. House of Wax, Black Christmas, Halloween, Friday the 13th. Then there was a terrible remake of The Wolfman. The Crazies got a remake, which is really strange because, you know, that film was not a noted movie, but, you know, the remake managed to kind of jazz it up a bit. And there was the Elm Street remake. Some of them were quite good in terms of, say, for example, The Hills of Eyes. Some of them were quite bad as The Hills of Eyes remake sequel. You could argue Funny Games as well. And then, bizarrely, you know, Last House on the Left and I Spit on Your Grave, two Grindhouse films, which played up again and kind of spotted the fact of what they really were, which isn't, you know, torture porn, but a splatter movie. And they sold it like Grindhouse. So that kind of makes sense in that sense. More recently, we've seen films like Human Centipede, which is a concept movie, a mad scientist concept movie, really, rather than anything else. Although its sequels do kind of stomp into just a fence for offensive sake. A Serbian film, which again, like Saw and Hostel, tries to reach for something a bit better, but struggles, shall we say. Finally, kind of this kind of torture porny kind of element left the cinemas quite quickly, really. It was done and done, dusted. For me, 2012's The Collection kind of puts a full stop on it. Less torture porn, more an action film in truth. It kind of ramps up the killings to insane degrees, very much like an action movie. It starts with people getting killed with a threshing machine, there's blood everywhere. And then its ending really kind of polishes off the genre. Saw's are renowned for kind of not giving the audience a kind of cathartic release, which is a good way to kind of sell a second one, let's put it that way. It kind of always ends with, like, you know, this big reveal and it's bigger than it was meant to be, and you know, the killer's got away, or somebody's got away, or there's a new killer in town. And the collection doesn't, well, the collection doesn't even, it kind of has it, it doesn't even bother to reveal really who the killer is. It kind of just says, it realizes that its monster is far better behind the mask. But he is caught by our main protagonist, who promises that he will effectively do to him what he did to himself, you know. So, and that kind of is almost like a full stop on it all for me. Very silly, over-the-top romp through this kind of like funhouse killing set for 90 minutes. And then, right, you're not getting any more of them. Ending, which is fair enough. But it does kind of feel tagged on to kind of like, almost kind of like say, we're done. We're done now. While all that was going on, and obviously, you know, back to the 2001 influences. Cloverfield in 2008 is a sci-fi monster movie, but obviously because it's a sci-fi monster movie, it's a horror film as well. Directed by Matt Reeves, and was built, you know, you could talk for hours about its publicity campaign, but the ground that was laid out by the Blair Witch Project was kind of like amplified, and what we now call viral marketing was very much enforced by this time. You know, there were websites and whatnot, and although social media hadn't really flew, this was, you know, Clover, it was Twitter at its very earliest. There's still things like Facebook and shares and whatnot, and the Drew Goddard filmed a movie about these six kids in New York who go to a party and then a monster attacks the city. Kind of almost says to me that we're, you know, as a society, you know, we've moved on from the effects of 2001. Obviously, we're still at war and all of that. Let's ignore that. But you know, to create a piece of entertainment as action horror of an external force coming up, rising up, and just laying waste to the city is an indicator that, you know, things have changed somewhat. I mean, you know, ignore Cloverfield. Let's talk about the first Avengers movie if you want to get down that road, because that's got 30 minutes of just London, of New York just getting slammed. And so I think, you know, it's interesting how as time goes on, you know, opinions and mood changes. And, you know, you couldn't release Cloverfield in 2003. And I'm not going to, you certainly couldn't release the Avengers movie.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do. Hello? Beth? Beth, where are you?
Okay, we cannot go into the middle of the city. We gotta get out of here.
There's nothing you can do for now.
Do you know what that thing is?
Whatever it is, it's winning.
Any idea what's out there? I don't care what's out there. Listen to me. She's dying.
Turn that camera.
Rob! Rob! Rob, I saw it. Rob! Rob, it's alive.
What was that?
Run!
Still filming?
Yeah. People are gonna wanna know, you know, how it all went down.
But Cloverfield obviously is a found footage film. And, you know, we can pin that to Cannibal Holocaust, which we've spoken about, and we can pin that to Blair Witch. But Cloverfield, and Paranormal Activity, which comes out the year later, is one of the big drivers for film now. For the same reasons lots of things are big drives for film in horror, it's cheap. So Cloverfield was a big budget, $30 million found footage movie, which, you know, kind of highlights the fact that obviously now we all film each other. Diary of the Dead's an interesting example, actually, of this, because Diary of the Dead came a little bit too early. So Romero kind of saw the way things were going with people. Everyone's filming everybody else and everyone's putting stuff online. An original plan for Diary of the Dead was to put it on a web feed. You know, you'd pay to go to that website and watch the film. But, you know, it's a Romero movie, a zombie movie. You know, it's going to get a proper release. I think it's got a cinema release in the UK. And, well, it did because I went. It was good. And so the... I mean, one of the criticisms of Diary of the Dead was that nobody would create that video and upload it. That it was just ridiculous that, you know, these things would be happening and somebody would do that. Now, I think modern society moving on has kind of said that actually they probably would. Not only that, they'd probably do like loads of them, and they'd probably have like conspiracy versions and, you know, oh my God, look at this bit in the corner. It must be a government agency plan rather than, you know, this, whatever it was, a meteor or whatever it would be. But now we're kind of used to found footage dropped in and out of films. Something like Chronicle is able to kind of dart between found footage and news footage, and the audience is sophisticated enough to kind of go either abandon its opinions that it's a good thing or a bad thing, or go with it. It's probably done best with Paranormal Activity because it's a very clever way of doing it, that you have locked off shots and then you can do something in the corner and you kind of keep the audience quiet and watching the screen waiting for something to happen. It's done extremely well in Rec, mainly because it uses its news camera idea, where you're a film journalist, you're a news journalist. You've got a cameraman. You would film as much as you could, because you would do, because it needs to be documented. And that kind of gets away from the Blair Witch thing of, you just wouldn't run in there with the cameras running. You probably wouldn't run in there at all, in truth. But you know, it's a good closed section. But, you know, obviously it appears to producers, because you can do them on iPhones. Indeed, the technology on mobile devices now is so good. You get films like Tangerine that came out this year, which isn't a horror film, but it's a LGBT comedy thriller about a transsexual, transvestite prostitutes in LA. And that's all filmed on iPhone 6s. And I mean that does not look like that, though. They've obviously done a lot of work in post, but I mean that's very telling that you can create something that good. It works well with horror because it helps with the suspension of belief. Found footage's biggest problem is because it's so cheap, because it's so easy to do, there's just too many of them now. People get being like saturated, and there's only so many haunted house stories you can tell with a shaky camera and people jumping out. So we're kind of at a stage now where people are a little bit more suspicious. There's still people doing relatively interesting stuff. The Mark Duplass film Creep from 2014 kind of does at least give an element of horror that works well. Mainly because it creates its scares by just having two people in a room. And obviously, it being a Duplass film, it's, you know, a lot of it's done via improvisation, and so the jokes feel more natural and the reactions feel a bit more natural. And it's a little bit clunky, and it cranks up the awkwardness in the same way the former horror film Baghead did, to kind of really kind of make it a far more interesting experience than, say, you know, four guys going to a haunted house with cameras. What will happen next? Well, they're all going to die, aren't they? Because it's a found footage movie, and you know what happens at the end of found footage movies. So that's kind of, you know, a mixture of mainstream, say with Paranormal Activity, which is still getting regular cinema releases, including Last Halloween, although I think that might be the last one we're going to get those. you know, that kind of stuff. But there's, you know, it just absolutely dominates direct-to-video. And we're going to talk about streaming and stuff like that in a couple of weeks' time, because it's an important element of our story about where we are now. But I don't want to go into things like It Follows and that kind of market just yet. So let's just finish off kind of where we are in terms of what's dominating the market on the big screen. Because there is one last element that's come in kind of 2011, really. Insidious is James Wan again. And written again by Lee Whannell. And it's a supernatural horror film. Now, this, its sequel, and The Conjuring are all effectively the same film in terms of how they're created. Things jump out at people. It uses noise very well. It respects the fact that people maybe listen to it on their headphones on a smaller screen. But it works well on a big screen because they make it incredibly loud and it dominates. So it kind of realises that, you know, the cinema theatre has always been, in horror, a rowdy place. But it acknowledges this more than a lot of horror films do and deliberately pushes that fact to its audience. You know, I think there's an element of law of diminishing returns even with this kind of stuff. Despite the fact that what these films are is 1970s retro horror films, like the Amityville Horror, like things like all those movies we spoke about, you know, The Changeling and all that, but kind of just with all the, like an Instagram picture of all the contrast and all the things just blown out and just screeching at you in the same way Saw does, to kind of scare you. So, like, The Conjuring just goes straight out the trap. It's a possession movie, it's a ghost story, it's this, it's that, and it just runs at you for literally 75 minutes of the 90-minute runtime. It's, you know, and by that point, you know, Insidious does the same. There's a Conjuring sequel coming this summer, which is based on the Enfield Poltergeist, which is the story we talked about for Ghost Watch in our British Ghost Stories. But again, there is a feeling that there's only so many of these things that can be made in the time frame, and something else will be coming up fairly soon. Sinister 2 got a lukewarm response. Insidious 3 made money, but not the kind of gangbusters I'm sure that they would have preferred, or certainly enough to make them think that there's a world for an Insidious 4. And we'll see how The Conjuring 2 does. But again, the Annabelle Haunted Doll film didn't do the kind of numbers they would have liked, I'm guessing. It was a success, but critically, you wouldn't expect them to do another one of those either. So we'll see with The Conjuring 2 and what comes next. But for me, this stuff, all these kind of retro things, again, is a, you know, it's one of those natural cycles in horror that at the moment what we've got is people who are, you know, the kind of, almost like we are in this kind of wartime kind of malaise. And things are quite tough at the moment for a lot of people with austerity. And so something that feels a little bit warm and a little bit less threatening, a little bit less punishing than, say, Saw or Hostel, but still gives you the adrenaline rush, but also in a kind of a retro style, I think matches the time. Certainly a time when, you know, we're all, you know, as a Western world, we may be eating burgers and chips and milkshakes and drinking, you know, bitter, and rather than like craft, you know, all that craft beery stuff. I think people do want that kind of warm hug of a film. And for a horror film, certainly people that, you know, may have grown up with those kind of classics or may remember those kind of classics from when they were younger, there's definitely a gap for them to enjoy them. So next time when we discuss this, we're going to kind of go to the very last bit, which is kind of the modern situation, really. We're kind of talking about theatres at the moment, but the market's completely dominated now with on-demand for horror, and it's the new video shop. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. So when we get to that bit in about a month's time, looking forward to speaking about that.
I get my own room.
Oh, are you kidding me? You're the youngest.
I called it on the room.
One, two, three, four, nine, ten. First clap.
In this time, let me try with pleasure hands.
Clap. I'm gonna get you now. I can hear you breathing.
You took your blindfold off. I win. I was in Christine and Nancy's room.
Girls, it's way past your bedtime.
Anyway, thanks so much for listening. That's kind of, that was a bit rambly, but I think that was quite good in terms of kind of, you know, giving an overview. It's very light touch that, but, you know, we don't want to get too technical. next week, we're going to look at, fingers crossed, Middle Eastern horror. And again, a very different kind of look and feel. Maybe a lot of things you might not have heard of, but certainly there's stuff there that's worth talking about. Again, probably one of those ones where I dart around lots of different places because, you know, for like the most notable stuff. But there's still some fantastic stuff to come. Until then, take care and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.